accession number 26561, reel 19.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 19. Now, we were talking about when you were in this German POW camp run by the Russians, around about May to July-ish, 1945, after the end of the war. And you were saying that this individual guard had been stealing from prisoners and rode off on a bicycle. If you take up this story.
Yes, so this officer came along and called over. We pointed to the Russian guard who had robbed of wristwatches, and the two Russian guards collected him, mounted either side of him, and they searched him, and they found he had a number of watches up his arm that he had been in fact taking, but I mean he might well have been a watchmander, we don't know. We think it unlikely. However,
and so what happened to him?
And so the Russian officer made a very great noises about this and shouted in Russian. I didn't understand. And they searched him and found all these watches on him. And two or three of those were identified as chaps who'd had them pinched from them. And they just put him up against this internal wire and shot him. No courts martial or anything like that. Shot him and buried him, but he didn't get the crimson cloth on his grave because he was a disgrace. The German wounded and killed one of the ones who were killed by Russians and died in combat had this crimson cloth put over their mound of earth where they'd been buried. And he didn't get that.
So what's the next thing you remember in this camp?
The sort of weeks and months went by, and eventually...
No thought of escape, obviously.
Oh, it was quite difficult. No food, no nothing to do it with. And where do you escape to? To amongst the Russians? They were everywhere. Oh, no, it would have been foolhardy to escape. We were promised that we were being looked after by the Russian officer and being guarded from the outside, he said.
Had you been able to get word out to home?
No external communications whatsoever.
So, none in and none out?
That's right.
So what happened next?
It was 3 months after the war.
Back end of July.
That's right. Before I got back.
So what? How did it all?
Eventually, they must have got the hostages they wanted back, or rather the Cossacks back, because they released us in a bunch and we climbed into lorries, and the hills, everything was covered in smoke, and where they'd blown up. Viaduct bridges across the river had been blown up by the Germans. They just sort of crashed down the side of the ravine. They had some bow saws in it, and if a tree got in the way, we were required to get out and saw it down, and then up the other side. Wherever we had to stop, we had to saw a tree down to get through. They didn't think of building Bailey bridges across the old position, very rugged, and eventually got to the Elbe. It was very significant that, meanwhile, all this smoking woodlands everywhere and a tiny bit of flame now and again was not being looked after in any way. You were just choking on the back of the lorry from all the smoke. And we got to the Elbe, and it was interesting to see that the populace, the German, or the Polish-German populace, was scudding between the houses, and it almost looked everywhere was vacant. And then we eventually handed over to Americans, who had a ferry going across the Elbe, and we crossed into the American. It was two different worlds. In the American side, all the local populace were done up in their Sunday best and having a whale of a time, whereas on the Russian side, everything was black, smoky, and vacant.
So what happened next then?
Well, we went to the American line and we had the first... In fact, we were quite sick because we fed food that we... Well, such rich food that we couldn't cope with it, and it was pretty bilious most of the time. And we thought the bread was cake. White bread was cake. It was so wonderful. And the Americans gave us some. Those who hadn't got any proper clothing, we got some. And we eventually put on, only a few days, we put on a Dakota and flew into Brussels, where we were greeted by the Belgian WVS, who put us into a hotel in the Rue de la Roi. And we went out and... When I say we, I don't know who else it was. I'd lost Dingebell, by the way.
What's that, sir?
I don't know. He had a lady, a German lady friend when we were in... he didn't even get into the camp to be taken, so no idea what his future was. Quite a few were lost during that Russian occupation. He shacked up with this to protect this German lady, and I wasn't interested in getting a girlfriend at that stage.
So what happened next? You got to Brussels?
I got to Brussels and put up at what had been a very nice hotel and given lots of good food and so on. And I went out for a walk, for freedom walk for the first time around Brussels. And I met up with a number of Belgians who hosted me generously. And because I wasn't used to alcohol then, I had a lot to drink, and asking my way back to Rue de la Roi in this semi-stupor state was very difficult. And then they eventually, I think a few days, not too bad, and were put onto a Lancaster, belly of a Lancaster, and flown back to Wing in the UK.
Now, when would this be? Is this August or July? Or do you not know?
I don't know. It's between those two dates, yes. It was definitely 3 months, because the significant point was that VE Day had finished and VJ Day had finished.
So it's August, then?
It's August, yes.
So what was your reception when you got back to England? I mean, you've got a bit
it
of story
was excellent. The first of all, we were due to go to... My hearing had just a little bit better. I still had a head bandage on from all this. And we were put on a train. We crossed London, and I can't think where we'd come in on one train and change over. It's all forgotten. But I was going... I know it was Euston Station. I was still in the ragged conditions that I'd been shot down in, and in Brussels before I left, they had pumped delousing powder up my sleeves and in my uniform and everything, just in case I got any fleas to import. And I was in this state in my ragged uniform that I'd been shot down in 4.5 years before, puffing delousing powder from my sleeve as I walked. And a couple of old ladies looked at me over their glasses and said, and one said to the other, "I don't think these sort of men should be allowed on this station." And I thought, thanks a bunch, you know, I might look at it as disreputable, but I've been through a lot.
So where were you going?
And then we were off to Cosford. Now, Cosford had been organised by senior British officer, Commodore... Come on, names again. I know it so well.
Doesn't matter.
Massey. our Commodore Massey. He'd come back, and he was one of the jobs that he'd asked for was to look after the returning prisoners of war. He was wounded in World War One, still had a stick and hobbling around in World War Two prison camp, and was repatriated under the wounded scheme. He went back and set up the Cosford processing.
Now, what was the camp called? What was the camp? Was it a POW reception centre?
At RAF Cosford, yes. Only for RAF. And they were very good. We got on the train and we arrived about midnight at Cosford, and they had these huts laid out with a bed, all fresh bedding and sheets. We hadn't seen sheets for ages. And the beds turned back, and a blue uniform and a red tie were put at the end of each bed, and the dustbin in the centre for our ragged uniforms to be sealed down, and went and had a shower and a bath and got cleaned up, and we were told that breakfast would be very early next morning, and we thought, fine. And we were thinking, we said amongst ourselves that if they don't get us away within 24 hours, we'll take off anyway. But they were wonderful. They were fantastic. I had this sort of conveyor belt scheme, not, I don't mean actual, but the flow processes, whereby we went in, the first thing they did was to measure you up for your uniform and your rank and the odd ribbon that you were entitled to, and then you went in and identified yourself, because they didn't know who was coming back and what the... But of course, they'd ask you all sorts of trick questions to find out if you really were who you said you were. And of course, you would get through that. And then they had about a 10-minute medical. A very quick one. And then they issued rations and briefing, and went through the whole thing, and anything we could tell them at the time, very short interval.
Now, your medical, what about your ears?
No, they were so fast, they didn't have time to find that out.
So you had all this, then what?
And it was lunchtime, getting in for lunchtime now, and it was about a four-hour process altogether. And as you came out the other end, they had your uniform, they changed out of your hospital kit and put on your uniform, had lunch, and they didn't even use the local railway station. They bussed you down to Warwick or something like that. And you went home with some money, some ration cards, and the whole lot. It was very slick. Beautifully organised.
Now, when you went on leave, how were you feeling? I mean, because a lot of people have trouble when they come out of POW camp.
Yes, first thing I got home, I think my mother was a bit disappointed that I'd come home. I sent her a telegram from Cosford, and that was on the mantelpiece. My half-brother met me at the door and said my mother had gone to a celebration party for my homecoming. I wasn't invited. But my note was on to say what time I'd be due home, you know. So I think I spoiled things for her, you know. She was getting so much pity before then. And anyway, I got in, then eventually I went up to my old bedroom at home and tried to get into bed. I got out of control completely. It was so soft, I couldn't do it, so I dragged the outer out and slept on the floor. And I could understand, you know, I got accustomed to sleeping hard.
Now, how long did it take before you got sort of used to life as not as a prisoner, you know, I mean...
Oh, it was a slow process, yes. I didn't want to meet anybody, and I came down the sort of second day and said, I'm off somewhere, and parents looked at me and said, where are you going? And he said, Auntie Sullivan, and it was Auntie Maud or something, wants to see you. And I said, no, I'm just going to follow my nose and go around somewhere. And I just took off, and they were very disappointed with me not to be shown off anywhere.
And then what?
And then I think we had about a week or so. No, we had about more than a week's leave, in which I just went searching on my own for old chums and so on. But most of them had been killed, and most of my classmates of my school days had been killed in the war.
Did you get used to the things like the bed, the diet, the food, this sort of thing?
Eventually. It was a slow process, and so my parents couldn't... I had a stepfather. He was good, he was sensible, but my mother wasn't. She just hadn't got a clue. My half-brother, we were great pals, and we enjoyed each other's company very much.
So did you go back to Cosford after this week?
No, not till I was commissioned later on. There was an OTU there, but not in the prisoner of war sense. No, we went to... I'm trying to think of the name of the place. Maidstone, near Maidstone. RAF something or other. Can't remember the name now. Anyway, that was a reception camp.
Another reception camp?
Well, it was a camp which is additionally taking on POWs, not exclusively.
And what happened there?
And there they were generally briefing you on Air Force matters and getting us back into the discipline of things. And then we've packed up on some more leave from there. And my one of my long march chums, Bunny Austin, he was in the accounts section doing that, and they wanted him badly because all the accountants had been demobbed. So he stepped straight into a job there. And he used to send me extra money back. And I was amazed at this to start with. And then I discovered that, in fact, I had to pay it all back at a much later date. Then I had to decide what I would do, and I was still not at the demob indicator status. Mine was 27, and I hadn't come to that band yet. And I decided I'd like to leave the Air Force with a commission. I was a warrant officer, and so I went to Cramwell and passed my LAC, I think it was. If I passed my LAC, I could retain my warrant officer aircrew status, which I did, and they were very impressed with my knowledge and asked me if I'd like a short service commission. And myself, and that happened to most of my students from those days, from the prison camp, and they had all, you know, I'd lectured them on radio and so on. And there were 9 of us all together commissioned for the officers' war course at Cranmore. Signals officers of war corps, and we did about 9 months learning to be RAF signals officers. And after the end of the course, we were sent on commissioning at Cosford, when that was an officers' reception centre.
Now, what do you remember of the signal officers course? Could they teach you much?
Oh yes, they were very good. Oh, they could. No, we used to give some of the lectures. We were a mixture of warrant officers and flight sergeants and other GD officers mostly, general duty officers. And we used to lecture them. We knew more than they did. It was a course of about 10 or 12, of a dozen officers and NCOs together. And the officers were all green and new to the world of signals, and all the other ones were quite proficient.
And then you had commissioning course at RAF.
Cosford, yeah. And we knew whether they were very strict in those days, and they had. It was a giant sausage machine that had to have percentage of rejects for each batch. And we went through that, and they do all sorts of silly things. They tell you they're going to have white webbing next morning's parade, and they came around 10 o'clock and said it was blue webbing now. Just to see how bolshy you could get on this one. But we stood our ground, and as a team of, I think it were nine of us all together, who were commissioned in the signals world.
And you were commissioned when? Do you know the date?
Yeah,
so they were roughly when? 46?
45, 40, 46, yes. Yes, that's right, it was 46. June 46. I've got a group photograph upstairs.
Now, we're just going to have a look at some of the key parts of your career, because it's a long career. It goes on for 25 years. And I thought what we'd do is look at the bits that you think that we should know about. I think, the best way. If you give us an outline and then put
the interesting, unusual things.
That's right. Yeah. I think that would be of great interest to people. So, you were commissioned, short service commissions, 46.
Yeah, June, I think.
June. Take us through what happened next then.
Yes, after that I was posted to, as a pilot officer, I dropped my pay, dropped from 23 shillings a day down to 13, and I had to pay officer's mess, buy my own uniform, and a whole host of things that, you know, unless you had a private income, you'd never make the grade.
And where were you posted to?
I was posted to a signals cryptography special course at Compton Bassett, and from there I was sub posted to Bletchley Park Crypto Center, where I learned about the more sophisticated cryptography matters, electronic ones, and so on.
Now, what do you remember of that?
Oh, that was very interesting. I was put out to a local hotel for accommodation, and it was quite an intensive program of tuition on electrical and other types. I'd already done the normal paper software cryptography, and was then went on to the electronic side of it, which was just my interest.
And what type of machine were you working on? Was it this things like the Colossus that Tommy Flowers had developed, or what was it?
Well, we had hints of that. We didn't get just principles and so on, but we learned about the Type X machine, which is the rotary drums and all the other things like that. That's very good. And then, despite the fact that we were highly technical signals officers in the radio sense, we were posted out to cryptographic positions, appointments, overseas. And we hadn't been back from prison camp after 4.5 years, and we whipped overseas again.
And where were you sent to?
I was sent to Gibraltar, where, in the air headquarters there, and worked on cryptography and secondary assistance to the signal junior, the senior signals officer there. But I was directly answerable to the Air Commodore Jordan, who was very impressed with. He was the one that quelled the RAF Indian mutiny.
And what years were you out at Gibraltar?
Just the 1 year.
So 47?
And I had...
Is that 47?
47, yeah.
And what sort of work were you doing?
In Gibraltar, cryptography, but I had so many secondary duties not only was I secondary duty for the station signals officer, but the education officer had been demobbed and they didn't have one, so that was one of my secondary duties. I was also appointed as the caveman for the Hollow Rock of Gibraltar, where anybody, visitors came, and it's my job to conduct them around the interior of St Michael's Caves and all around there, and there was no lighting or anything in those days. It was real potholing. In fact, the potholing was, got a signals in from Cranwell to say that a party of cadets would be arriving for a potholing party.
Now, I mean, what about the actual cryptology? I mean, what were you doing? What was the duties of the cryptology?
Well, I had a giant strong room with steel doors, and everything was highly secured. And I had thousands of very secret documents in it, and those all had to be mustered and accounted for, which was a 3-day job to do a proper muster on those. And their commodore would send for me. He only had about 4 officers on his staff at the headquarters, Gibraltar. So that took a lot. I was running the combined services rugby team as a player secretary.
But you haven't actually said anything about cryptology yet. Keeping secret documents isn't cryptology. Do you see what I mean?
I didn't.
So you didn't do any code work?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm not going to tell you what it was. It was what typical paper coding. All the skills I'd learned at Bletchley Park was of no use being there. They didn't have any machines there then. But it was mostly, and although I had 2 cipher sergeants, they were not allowed to read it. To break down for officers' eyes only crypto information.
So most of it you think still
secret? I worked for 3 days without a sleep on one occasion, getting some panic or other. And the doctor in the end went to the Air Commodore and said he hasn't had sleep for 3 days. You'll have to disengage him from this and get another officer to stand by and watch the sergeants do the debriefing, decoding.
So what happened next then?
Well, I was on a 1-year emergency commission and I was running all these sideshows and there. As I say, I had about 4 secondary duties which are bigger than my cryptography job. And the Air Commodore sat for me and said, I do want her. I'd like you to have a short service commission. And I said
A regular commission?
Yes. But I said, well, I'd love to do it, but my old automatic telephone company want me back. They've kept my office open all these years and paid me a token wage during that time. And I've got to think of the future. I just wanted to leave the Air Force commissioned. And he said, he was very upset about that. Then he came back with a better secure commissioning arrangement, a longer term. And I said, no, it still holds. I love what I'm doing and I love the Air Force. Incidentally, I'd married at Cranwell on the officer's course. I missed that out. I'd had a son by then, just been born. In fact, he was born, and they posted me overseas immediately.
So what was the decision?
I didn't tell my new wife, Elaine. She was a dentist at Cranwell, yes. And we had this boy, she was not allowed to go out there at the time. And then they gave.